This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.URUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, a conversation with a woman passionate about the movies, independent filmmaker Christine Vachon. Here are a couple of her thoughts about film. First, film is about the process, a long, complicated, passionate process towards something larger than the sum of its parts. She also says this, independent film needs to be a reminder of what movies can be. At the helm of the company Killer Films, Christine Vachon has produced more than 30 feature films. Her films include Far From Heaven, One Hour Photo, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and the Academy Award-winning Boys Don't Cry. Christine Vachon is also the author of two books. The first was Shooting to Kill. It's a handbook for independent producers. Her latest is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. It's about surviving in a very tough business, a business that is always changing. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon, Christine Vachon. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Christine, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to talk with you.
Likewise.
Producers, you say, get the film made. Is that ultimately why you decided producing was the job for you?
To a certain degree, yes. I mean, it definitely is, you know, a job that involves a tremendous amount of multitasking, which for whatever reason, when I started out, I found extremely attractive. And I think, you know, a great producer just has to be really the locomotion on the movie.
Yeah. Can you give us some sense of what a producer does? What's a day like in your life?
Well, I mean, the big question is, are we in production on something or not? Because if we are, then basically my day is spent on a film set, troubleshooting, you know, looking at the monitor with the director, et cetera, et cetera. Often, though, my day is spent trying to get movies set up, trying to push development along from one place to the other, trying to convince actors to take a chance on our films, things like that.
Yeah. Well, you're a great juggler.
Thank you.
I'm looking here at a list of things that you've got currently. You've got Positively Fifth Street, this is announced, Cult Figure in pre-production, Goat pre-production, White and Rice pre-production, Untitled, a documentary about Rufus Wainwright filming.
Mm-hmm.
You've got things in post-production, and An American Crime is about to be released, I guess, coming up this coming year.
American Crime is actually going to the Sundance Film Festival. It'll premiere there on January 19th.
Yeah. So how do you manage to keep all this stuff going? This is nuclear multitasking.
Well, I mean, everything's at a different point, so it needs different amounts of attention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for us to stay in business, we need to have a lot of stuff that we're developing, because it doesn't always go into production. You know, I'm not quite sure what the ratio would be for us.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the other things I try and do is, you know, read books, manuscripts, scripts, newspaper articles, just always looking for something that looks like it could be a movie.
Yeah. Maybe you would tell us about the moment you knew producing was something you really wanted to do. It was a moment with Todd Haynes.
Right. Yeah, well, Todd Haynes made a infamous film called Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story, which he made, about 15 years ago now, I guess. The film is a wonderfully told tale about Karen Carpenter and her terrible descent into anorexia and eventual death. And he tells the story with Barbie dolls. And it seems like it is such a great joke initially. By the time the film is ending, you kind of can't believe the performance he got out of those dolls. When I saw that movie, I just knew that he was the kind of director that I really wanted to, I wanted to attach my name to anything mm-hmm. he ever made for the rest of his life.
Mm. What attracts you to a story?
To what attracts me to a story in
yeah.
general?
Yeah.
You know, is if it's fresh and original, if I feel like I haven't seen it before, if it feels, you know, if it feels like a different point of view.
Yeah. Todd Haynes, you've worked now with him for many years. He's a friend as well as somebody that you work with. And his films include Far From Heaven. He directed that, you produced, released in 2002. What's it like working with him?
Well, I mean, I think because we know each other so well, we have a real shorthand, mm-hmm. which is great. I mean, you know, we both, a lot of the, you know, oftentimes I think a producer and a director have to mark out their territory to a certain degree because, you know, I need to protect the film's interests creatively, mm-hmm. and then the financiers always want to make sure that their interests are involved as well. And I think with Todd and I now, we've worked together for so long, he knows that I'm always going to, you know, I'm always on the side of what he wants.
Yeah. You tell a story that opens the introduction to your book, A Killer Life, being with him. The opening shot of Far From Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. About that day.
You know, it, now you may remember better than I do because I haven't looked at the book in a while. But what I remember is that it was one of those shots that, you know, it was very, very complicated. Everything had to move on a dime. You know, everything from the period cars to, you know, we had to redo the front of the train station, et cetera, et cetera. Just to, you know, make sure that we could sell the 50s, the period. And the crane broke, and there was, it was just anything yeah. that could go wrong did. And then finally, we got the shot. And when we got the shot, it was one of those magical moments of just like, okay, now it's clear. Now it's clear, like all these moving parts come together and create this extraordinary piece of celluloid.
Yeah. Each film, I imagine, presents its own challenges, but in general, are there some constant challenges?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, yes, of course, there's constant challenges, and but in some ways, it's like all the world a little bit the same, because it's, you know, because hopefully, if you're telling them, the end is, but we made the movie anyway, you know? I mean, really, financing has never been harder on, you know, movies that are challenging or provocative. And, you know, financing sources, though, have never been more varied. So in some ways, it's kind of an interesting time, you know, to be out there, you know, trying to put together money for these kind of movies. Also, you know, I mean, really, right now, making theatrical films is challenging simply because it's so hard. Look how crowded this fall has been. There's been, like, you know, 17 million movies opening every week. And I feel in some ways we have to rethink exhibition and rethink, you know, the virtues of films premiering perhaps first on television.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. How would that work?
I mean, the same way, you know, it works with you know, HBO cable premieres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think that most people's theatrical experiences these days are not, they're not in the theater. They are in their living rooms, and that's mm-hmm. just a fact of our, that's just becoming a fact of our business.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, when you go to rent now a DVD, so much of it is HBO productions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Some of the best stuff in the building.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to a building to
right.
to do your renting.
Right.
Yeah. How else could the business, the industry, rewrite how it all works?
I don't know if the industry really can. I think that's giving the industry a lot of credit.
Yeah.
What the industry is doing usually is just following the audience and following people's tastes, following, you know, trends, et cetera. So I think it's just about, you know, I can talk about, you know, the individual producer like myself. I think ultimately, you know, it's about being as flexible as possible, trying to read the writing on the wall as quickly as possible and adapt.
Yeah. One of the things you say in A Killer Life about audiences is that we've gotten smarter and savvier. And in the hands of children now, movie making apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us, if you would, about your observations about the audience and how it is changing.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing that is changing is the audience just has so many more choices. And that figures in. I mean, you know, now, you know, as I said before, there's a million more movies to see that are opening on a weekly basis. So you have to decide, you know, an audience has, the chance to decide, you know, whether they're going to see Little Children or The Queen or Notes on a Scandal or Babel or United 93. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. There's that. But then there's also the fact that, you know, if you turn on your TV, you know, now there's 1,000 channels, you know, and channels that are completely, some of which are completely targeted to certain kinds of people, you know, whether it's Lifetime Movies or Logo, which is gay channel, you know, they're specifically for certain audiences. And then you have, you know, incredible things like Netflix, where, you know, getting DVDs into your home has never been simpler.
Right. And the catalog is huge now.
And the catalog is huge. And once you start renting from Netflix, they start figuring out what you like and start, you know, giving you those options every time you sign on.
Yeah.
So it really, I think it's that the audience has so many more choices.
Yeah. And what about subject matter? How do you stay on top of that in terms of giving us things that are going to be, one, quality stories, quality filmmaking, but also be thought-provoking and meant for some critical thinking?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it just kind of comes down to taste, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are the kinds of movies we get excited about making.
Yeah.
So we're just always, and look, you know, I go to film festivals. If I see a filmmaker's film that I like, I try and arrange to meet with them as quickly as possible. You know, we try and keep our hands in as many things as we can.
Yeah. What is an independent film? How do you define it?
Well, I think an independent film used to be defined as basically the character of the money itself. When people said independent, what they meant was a film that wasn't financed by a studio, that had to go to market to be sold. Now, often these movies were sold to studios for distribution, but they had been financed in alternative ways. Now, that's really not the case, because these days, even studio financing involves a lot of equity financing, a lot of foreign financing. You know, there's just the way it is to skin those cats have changed so much that you really can't say, all right, a film is simply independent because of the nature of the money that got it to the screen. I think now it's about a singularity of vision. A real independent film is a movie that is the result of one strong and vivid vision, as opposed to, you know, a franchise.
Hmm. And the studios now in the business, they call these films classics.
Oh, you mean
right?
The so-called classics divisions?
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know, the independent divisions at studios, whether it's Warner Independent or Fox Searchlight or Miramax for Disney or what have you, I mean, in some ways, what those names signify is, you know, doing it for less. But that's a little bit unfair, because what it also means is, okay, we are doing it for less, which means that we can take more chances, like on a director who's not that experienced, on a subject matter that's more challenging, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. You'd like to see these films become smaller again. Maybe they've become too big. Would you talk about that?
Well, I mean, you know, you have to place that in context. I mean, I think that there was certainly a time when we first started producing films where, you know, the sort of the the brass ring for, you know, independent theatrical distribution was breaking even and then some. And then, you know, in the when Pulp Fiction came out, it kind of raised the bar about what an independent film could do. And there was this whole notion of, like, wow, you could make it so much cheaper than a Hollywood film. And then it would go ahead and make $100 million. And that's what we want to try and do. So, you know, it comes back around to the same notion of, you know, re-examining the audiences, re-examining what people's choices are, and how you define what makes an independent film successful.
Yeah. What? Yeah. How do you define that?
I think it depends on the film. Depends how much it cost. Depends how much was spent on advertising it. You know, I mean, some films are obvious successes, like Little Miss Sunshine. But then, you know, there's movies that that it's kind of incredible. Like our film Betty Page that we made with HBO. You know, Mary always had a very specific vision for that being in black and white. And I think it's amazing that HBO believed in her and let her do it that way.
Yeah. What is financial success for an independent film?
It depends on the budget and the advertising costs and, you know, the award nominations. I mean, often for some of these films that have garnered, you know, Oscar attention in the past, the amount of money that was spent getting them there is you know, unbelievably, you know, way more than the movie itself. So it does kind of come down to a prestigious success and a financial success.
Yeah. How was it that Little Miss Sunshine was able to become so successful?
Well, I mean, part of it is it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a big part. I mean, hopefully that's a big reason why any movie does well.
Yeah. But there are good movies out there that don't do well.
That's true. But sometimes, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, no producer and no filmmaker likes to believe that a movie doesn't do well for any, you know, it's always, oh, it was the trailer, it was the poster, It came out at the wrong time, it was the competition, you know, it was that one bad review we got out of X, Y, or Z. And no one ever really wants to just say the reason why the movie isn't doing well is because
people
just don't want to see it.
Yeah. How important are reviews?
Reviews are important, especially, you know, for art house cinema, because that's what I think that is. You know, people look at reviews to help them decide what they're going to see, to help them distinguish between one film and another. So they're important. I mean, you know, I think if there's a major movie star, perhaps they become less important. Although, you know, I was very curious about Blood Diamonds this weekend because its reviews were really so-so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if people were going to turn out for DiCaprio anyway.
Yeah. How do you decide what movies you're going to go to see?
I wait for my Academy screeners.
Ah.
I don't have time to go
see
movies.
Yeah.
And I go to film festivals.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking with me this afternoon. Let's invite some of our listeners. Let's invite all of our listeners to join the discussion this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon, independent filmmaker Christine Vachon. She is also the author of two books, her latest, A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. When did your love affair with the movies begin?
You know, when I was a kid, I was able to, you know, walk to the local movie theaters. I grew up in New York City. And at that time, you know, one other important thing to remember is when people went to see non-Hollywood films when I was a kid, what they meant was a movie not in English. I mean, that was what independent cinema was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was foreign films. So I was able to walk to a lot of movie theaters, a lot of revival houses, And it was kind of amazing. And also, you know, we could, if we wanted to see something again, we actually had to go see it.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't just press replay.
Or you could just, what we used to do is just keep our seats and remain
seated.
Yeah,
we would do that too.
Yeah, unless it was a particular film where they would clear you out.
Right.
Yeah. Well, among the films you fell in love with as an adolescent were The Bicycle Thief and Cousin Cuisine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you say independent films have pretty much pushed foreign films out of American cinemas.
They have.
That's sad.
I know, but I mean, it just goes to show again how limited screen space is. And, you know, I think the whole cliche of going to see, you know, going to a foreign film and then going and, you know, to a coffee house afterwards, that's all kind of gone.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever attend foreign film festivals?
Oh, yeah. I just came back from one in Greece, in Thessaloniki, where there were 15 films, none of them in English.
Oh. And?
It was fantastic.
Yeah. And anything, now, what was your purpose in going there? And
I was on their on their jury.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I got to see so many movies.
Yeah. And then what do you bring back from that experience for killer films?
You know, I bring back perhaps potential relationships with filmmakers from other countries. I also just bring back like a sort of, I get a little re-inspired just seeing a whole bunch of movies.
Yeah. Would you give us some sense of how a film comes to be? Would you give us maybe a thumbnail look at the process from conception to realization?
Well, I mean, from, you know, conception for us is often, sometimes it's somebody coming in with an idea or a script. Sometimes it's a book they want to adapt. Sometimes it's a story that they've heard that they need to tell. Then we develop the script, you know, till we feel that it's at a point that it can start attracting talent, because a big part of getting our movies made is getting people, you know, getting actors attached early on to help put the financing together. And so we start doing that, and at the same time, that's usually when we are also trying to get the money together. And, you know, a lot of it has to be a little bit of a juggling act, because often we're trying to pull together the money, but we don't have the money till we have the actors, but the actors don't want to sign on till we have the money, that kind of thing. It can become a little bit of a catch-22.
Yeah. And also, this is one of the things that, one of the pearls of wisdom from Christine Vachon that you share at the outset of the book, keep this triangle talent, producer, money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I suppose you could also look at it, it's in another kind of geometrical fashion, a circle.
Yes.
Yeah. There are many things here on this page about money.
Right. Well, you know, it's a commercial art form.
Yeah. Money costs money. Money,
right.
Money has a personality.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, just that the people who put money into movies often have different expectations. Meaning, you know, somebody may expect, you know, some financier may expect a director to really listen to their creative concerns. Some directors may feel that that's inappropriate. And other financiers, it's a pure business deal for them. And, you know, they just want to make sure that they get their money in and get their money out. And other financiers are really doing it out of passion and commitment. So, it's, if you can, it's great to try and get the money that fits the film.
Yeah. What a catch-22.
Yep.
Yeah. Less money equals more control. More money equals less control. So with more money, does that mean the picture is, chances are, it's going to be less daring?
Probably, but there's certainly, you know, exceptions to that. And great exceptions. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously, look, money's impact is what it is, but there are, you know, there's filmmakers like Scorsese, for example, who are working with, you know, very, very strong budgets, obviously, and I think they're making exactly the movies they want to make.
Hmm. I guess you can do that, though, if you're Scorsese.
Yeah, but you didn't start as Scorsese.
Right, right. How did you start?
You know, I started working on various films that were shooting in New York, various horror films and whatever, independent films, whatever was around that I could get a little experience on. And I worked as a location manager, an assistant director, et cetera, and finally, you know, sort of honed in on what it was I wanted to do.
Yeah. Tell us about Bill Sherwood and Parting Glances.
That was a very key, you know, a film that had a great impact when it came out, because in many ways it was a, you know, a film about gay men that started after everyone had already come out. So it wasn't about, you know, it wasn't about the pain and horror necessarily of being gay, which it seemed like most gay films were up until then. And it was, you know, he put the money together, shot part of it, showed it around, put more money together. You know, it came out in 1986. It was Steve Buscemi's first real role. I think it was his first movie role. And it was a really wonderful experience, I have to say. It really showed me what what happened when you told a tale that was really about, you know, about people who weren't used to seeing themselves on screen.
Hmm. What attracted you about the story Far From Heaven?
Well, in all fairness, because it was Todd. You know, and anything Todd wants to do, I'm game to do. But I also loved the play with melodrama, and, you know, I liked the challenge of trying to pull off that look in a modern, you know, in our culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. You studied film at Brown, and at that time, you say in your classes, the prevailing theory was that narrative was essentially evil.
Mm-hmm.
What were those days like?
I mean, I think that kind of sums it up, you know. I mean, you know, it was, but look, I mean, we were all trying to figure out, you know, what our, like, what our relationship to narrative and to movies were.
Yeah, yeah. So you're, in a way, I suppose you're pushing yourself, you're trying to figure out what the medium is about, how to tell a story, or how to do something with film.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so you're stretching, I suppose, in a way. Which,
yes, exactly.
A good thing. How do you think of narrative today?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's what I deal in.
Right.
So, you know, look, I think, you know, I think great films should be pleasurable. That is, you know, that is absolutely what I believe. I don't think going to the movies should be, you know, a difficult experience. So, you know, when we make movies that are fun and that, you know, that people, you know, get real narrative pleasure from, I'm really happy.
Hmm. One of your current projects is the coming soon to cable series, This American Life.
Yes.
What do you think of Ira Glass's narrative?
Talents. Obviously we love him, or we wouldn't have. I mean, you know, we saw so much potential in trying to bring those to TV. It was a blast.
Yeah.
So Showtime in March.
Showtime in March. He was on All Things Considered recently, talking about the experience of making the switch in media, and it was very interesting. He was reluctant for a long time.
Oh, I know. I know, and I'm really glad that we, you know, that we convinced him otherwise.
Yeah, and he says that he has learned a great deal about storytelling now as a result of working in film. And I'm wondering how the people that worked with him, who were the visual people, how they would talk about if they have picked up on things as a result of working with Ira?
You know, that's a good question. I honestly wouldn't know how to answer that. You know, I mean, look, on every great film is a, or filmic experience is a great collaboration. So inevitably, you know, everybody does learn from each other because it's constant translation back and forth. I'm not sure what his visual collaborators. I'm not sure how they would respond.
Yeah. Did you spend much time with them on location?
No. We spent a great deal of time developing it, but not much time on that part at all.
Yeah, and on your executive producer on this project.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's interesting too. That's something that I didn't realize till I had read A Killer Life, is that if you're executive producer, you're a little bit further removed.
Well, not so much in TV, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it's a different thing in television. Like, we took executive producer credits on Mrs. Harris because that was considered the more impressive credit. I don't quite know how it all works on TV, but it's something like that.
Yeah. Back to Ira Glass, do you listen to radio?
You know, I'm never in a car. So less than I would probably if I was. But, obviously I make an effort to listen to his show.
Yeah. How did you find out about it?
Well, I went to college with Ira.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we've known each other for a long, long time.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly a treasure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Christine Vachon. She is founder and president of Killer Films. She is also the author of two books. Her latest is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Advice for people who would like to get into filmmaking?
You know, that's always a hard one. I think it's really just try and, there's various ways of entry into the business. I mean, I went through production. I really learned as much as I could about the actual mechanics of making a movie. Other people learn about the mechanics of distributing a film. I think it depends on, what your inclination is. Find some piece of it and just start, seeing what part of it really excites you.
Yeah, dig in. You also did some work assistant directing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, early on.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. A caller in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. I'm wondering if she could give us examples of some of the non-narrative films that were held up to her as exemplary when she was in college. And secondly, if any of them were popular successes. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I mean, right off the top of my head, I guess, the films of, filmmakers like Straub, Huyay, their films, I wouldn't say any of them were like aggressively non-narrative, but they were often aggressively, they played with narrative in very aggressive ways that were often, often meant a great deal of patience on the part of the viewer. Also a film by Chantal Ackerman called Jean Dielman. I don't remember if those films were popular successes. It was a different time. There probably was, frankly, simply more of an audience for movies that were perceived as foreign or different because, they were hard to see. But probably not by our standards, no.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have to do anything in terms of bribing a location. If you're looking for a specific context, and do you deal with a city council, what are the dynamics on that? And just how does that work?
In terms of getting locations?
Yeah, if you want a particular setting, or do you is that even an issue for you?
Well, a location manager, usually is hired very early on in the process, and they find locations that match the director's vision for particular scenes.
Okay.
And once they do that, then usually the director's given several choices. And hopefully then we're able to make a deal. Usually, yes, it's almost always a money deal. I mean, we pay people for the permission to shoot in their homes, stores, parks, what have you. And, yes, every single city does have one person at least who's designated to deal specifically with film production.
Hmm.
Because the deal is most cities want as much film production as possible, because it's very healthy for a local economy.
Yeah. What if you're looking for a specific context, say San Diego, and you know that the movie is going to be controversial?
First of all, no one ever really knows if a movie is going to be controversial until it is.
I see.
And I think then you just, you go, I mean, most of the time, most cities, I've found, they don't really care what the movie is. What they're really interested in is, what size the budget is and how many locals you'll be able to employ.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Are there heroes of yours, Christine, that are fellow producers?
I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I admire Scott Rudin a great deal because he's able to be so prolific and his work is so consistently strong. I admire Douglas Sirk's producer, Ross Hunter, but I haven't really ever thought about fellow producers in that way.
Yeah. There's, for us in the audience, they're your mystery people.
Producers?
Yeah.
Yes, I can imagine that we are.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, another caller in Champaign. Line one, hi.
I'm very much interested in a show that are film that you recommended. One of them, one that I caught was Little Miss Sunshine.
And mm-hmm.
Do you remember what the other one was? I'm really interested in things that are suitable for children or have no violence, no immorality, that sort of thing.
I don't know how many movies I could recommend to you that are suitable for children and have no violence or no immorality that we've made.
Mm-hmm.
So
you made Little Miss Sunshine?
I didn't make Little Miss Sunshine. I just pointed out that I thought it was a film that had been very successful because it was so good.
I see. But you did mention another, and I...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't help you.
Probably had violence.
Yeah, and I don't know if Little Miss Sunshine would be... I think you'd want to be a little bit on the mature side.
I would say so.
Child, adolescence would be.
I would say
so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let the title fool you.
I see. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, independent filmmaker Christine Vachon. She is the author of A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. At the helm of the company Killer Films, she has produced more than 30 feature films. Her films include Far From Heaven, One Hour Photo, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and the Academy Award-winning Boys Don't Cry. When did you realize that you had a taste, that you were interested in films that were kind of out there?
I never really thought of it that way. I just went after the stuff I really liked.
Yeah.
And, I think it is part of the old adage that if you do what you love, everything else will follow.
Yeah.
So when people would describe my taste back to me as being, out there or edgy, it was always a little bit news to me.
Yeah. But tell us a little bit. You have a half sister
mm-hmm.
who helped. She kind of dragged you along a little bit, and you found yourself after at least one of the films that she took you to saying, "What the heck was that about?"
Well, yeah. I mean, she was. She was much more a product of the '60s than I was, and she was a real experimental filmmaker. So it was kind of great to get exposed to that kind of filmmaking through her.
Yeah. I know that you don't get to go to many films yourself, and you rely on screeners for the Academy Awards to tell you, you know, here's what's up and what's good. But is there anything at this point in the year, given that there are so many films out there, that you would say, here's something you might want to think about. Here's a number of films that you probably would be, you'd probably be well, you'd be in a good spot if you went to these films.
I think Pan's Labyrinth is quite strong. I liked The Queen. I, of course, liked Little Miss Sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
Of Volver, the Almodovar film.
Mm.
Those are a few of my favorites.
Yeah. Almodovar, that's what it fascinating filmmaker he is. And
there's
a foreign filmmaker and foreign films that do get shown on screens in
this
country. They
do. I mean, he's had quite a following here over the years.
Yeah. The first film of his that I saw, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown,
mm-hmm.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fabulous. He makes such wonderful films about women.
He does, and he's a wonderful visual stylist as well.
Yeah. Well, I know you have to run and pick up a daughter.
Yes.
So anything you'd like to leave us with?
No, just keep going to the movies.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, and keep making them.
Okay, thank you.
Christine Vachon, founder and president of Killer Films. She's the author of two books. The first was Shooting to Kill. It's a handbook for independent producers. Her latest is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. It's about surviving in a very tough business, a business that's always changing. And if you love the movies, I think you'd enjoy A Killer Life. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.